Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. How many times have we heard this phrase tonight? The penultimate rankings of the selection committee. All right, Bruce, they always tick you off about something. What is it this time?
It's actually not the rankings themselves. It was the, stupidly, I tuned into that show and it was a Reese Davis question, which I get why he asked it, but it was about, well, we know that Alabama, who's ranked sixth, and Ohio State, who is ranked fifth, do not play any more games. So that's it, kind of like thing. And Boo Corrigan seemed to be confused by the question. Right. I mean, you watched it. It was just weird. Like there was like a, I don't know what to do with this kind of thing.
It was almost like nobody had stopped to tell him, like, you know, they're probably going to ask you, is there any way they can swap places? Because he clearly didn't want to go there, but then he realized he has to say something.
Like, it's the obvious question. Like, those are, right. That's, you know, like, we can talk about whether Georgia or Michigan should be one versus two. But at the end of the day, what really matters is who's five and six. Right. And when we know that neither is going to play any more games, except we know how this works, it wasn't a gotcha question, I don't think. But at the same point, it was like you sit there knowing, okay, well, if somehow Purdue beats Michigan and if somehow LSU beats Georgia, that would boost Alabama's resume strength. And the other one would ding Michigan's or Ohio State's resume strength because they would have lost to a team that isn't number, you know, like, I don't know. Maybe Michigan would stay at number two even if they lost. But if they lost by like 21 points, they might not.
I don't know why that would flip it. The thing is, like, when Reese asked him about why Ohio State's ahead of Alabama, I mean, it's a pretty simple answer. He's like, well, Ohio State's got two pretty good wins against Notre Dame and Penn State, and Alabama's best wins are against Texas and Mississippi State, who I believe are both ranked in the 20s. So that's not going to change. Like, the quality of their wins. Are you saying that the quality of those two teams' wins aren't going to change? And in fact, you're suggesting Ohio, I guess you're suggesting one of Ohio. I'm not sure what you're suggesting. How does Michigan-Purdue affect things?
The team that blew out Ohio State might not look so dominant if they lose to a Purdue team that nobody thinks is that good.
So you're saying that would be like, well, I can't believe Ohio State got blown out to that team?
Yeah, I think it would diminish it a little bit at home. I don't think it's a big factor, but I think that's the part where, unfortunately, what I referred to this whole thing to you earlier tonight on text was, it's an idiot fest. And this is exactly why it's an idiot fest. Because we go down these like little rabbit holes of what could ding a resume, or this is how it turns out to be in the beauty contest. When the truth is, like, the way we're talking about these two teams is that Ohio State has the same amount of losses as Alabama, and they don't.
They can switch the criteria literally from one team to the next. So the message about Ohio State versus Alabama was, Ohio State has better wins. In fact, he didn't really even, on the teleconference afterward, when they asked him about the blowout loss to Michigan, he almost played that down more so than I would have expected. Okay, fine. I guess this committee cares more about wins than losses. Well, then somebody else asked, why is Alabama ahead of Tennessee, who they lost to? Well, because Tennessee had a really bad loss to South Carolina. Okay, so now we're back on losses. I asked about Oregon and Utah. They just mysteriously flipped the order of those two this week, and that has Rose Bowl implications. And somebody else asked him about the same thing later, and he was very hung up on the fact that Washington lost to Arizona State. And it's like, but did you just learn about that? Like, that happened a long time ago when that suddenly, like, they literally just beat at Washington State to finish 10-2, and you're going back there? So, I don't see – I think Alabama – I know it's never say never. I don't think Alabama is making the playoff. I think we're down to five teams for four spots.
If TCU gets blown out, and if USC loses, Alabama have a shot then?
I don't understand why if as of this moment, TCU is 12-0 and Alabama is 10-2. So if TCU gets blown out and Alabama doesn't play,
they've already beaten,
and Alabama doesn't play, I think that would be preposterous for them to suddenly decide that number six Alabama is better than current number three TCU. I mean, Dan Wetzel, did we talk about it on Sunday? I can't remember. His case on his own podcast and his column is very reasonable. If you're saying that as of now, these four teams are the top four teams and the next three teams aren't playing this week, then why would any of these four teams have to get penalized for playing an extra game and the others aren't?
Why is he bringing logic into this?
Yeah. I mean, it's when you think of it that way. Okay. But I can also absolutely see them saying if USC loses to Utah, well, you know, it was a second loss and it was against the team. So they didn't avenge the loss to Utah. And by the way, their defense is just, you know, we have questions about their defense. Therefore we're going to with Ohio State. And it'd be like, well, but what if Ohio State had played another game? Maybe they would have had the same problem. It's happened once, as far as I can tell. 2017, Alabama loses the Iron Bowl, misses the SEC championship, and is fifth. And two teams above them, two teams in the top four lose. Now, one of them is Auburn, loses to Georgia. So that's what put Georgia in, okay? That makes sense. But Wisconsin was 12-0 going into the Big Ten title game, lost to Ohio State, and Alabama jumped them. So there is precedent for this.
Okay. Anything else on this?
Well, been a pretty busy busy week in the coaching.
Well, carousel. No, I didn't mean – I meant related to the Tuesday night show. No, I definitely think we need to talk about the biggest hire in the SEC, and that's Hugh Freeze going to Auburn. How do you feel about it?
I feel confused because I thought this was we've talked, I don't know, whenever, how long ago did Harsin get fired? 3 weeks ago, maybe? I mean, I can remember. Ago, I maybe. I just remember at some point quite a while ago, we were on here saying, well, there's three guys it could be. Kiffin, Dion, Hugh Freeze. And we debated which one was the best. We both said Kiffin. But I always thought Hugh Freeze was a possibility in that it makes total sense. Now I'm hearing through the grapevine that it's actually kind of controversial there, that a lot of Auburn fans are not pleased about this because obviously Hugh Freeze has a lot of baggage. A ton of baggage. You know, if you are feeling like you want your coach to be squeaky clean, he is not the guy to hire. But I didn't expect that this would be the hill they'd want to die on, because if Auburn doesn't hire Hugh Freeze, trust me, somebody else is going to hire him. Like, he's not going to be at liberty for the rest of his career.
Yeah, I think, look, we all know why he got fired at Ole Miss.
For the NCAA violations.
No, and honestly, the NCAA violations relative to, you know, where we are now with NIL and the recruiting and everything, like, let's not clutch the pearls over that. It's a couple things. It's the calling escort services. Never mind, it was from the company phone, whether it was, you know, whatever. But like, it's that. And I think it also at the time was only made worse by the fact that he was he would talk about his faith a lot online. And it's a lot different, I think, optically, when it's somebody who is talking about certain things like that, as opposed to if, I don't want to like just throw out some random name of a coach who maybe doesn't talk, like who's not professing to be like very devout or anything like that. I think it takes on another threshold. But then when he got to Liberty, which has had more than its share of scandals itself, and the AD he worked for, Ian McCaw, had honestly a much worse scandal that he lost his job at Baylor over, you know, which sexual violence, and there was a lot of really bad stuff going on there. And you know, this is where I think it comes back to Hugh Freeze's challenges, to put it mildly, is you know, he you know, the getting into people's DMs and basically trying to defend his honor, or in this case, trying to defend Ian McCaw's honor, and trying to, you know, basically either win people over or make his case. Whereas a lot of football coaches, I just don't think they care that much about it. They don't, you know, I'm sure they don't want to have a bad reputation, but I don't think they're trying to catch every raindrop on the internet. And he got himself into more trouble. And I think that kind of thing coming out of it, you know, it look, I think just on the field, he's a really good football coach. And at the end of the day, I think what you're saying is, you know what, it's the SEC. All they really care about at the end of the day is whether you can win football games. And correct. I don't disagree with you. Correct. I think that's
and,
all.
And this guy won a lot of football games. I know it wasn't
the longest. He beat Nick Saban a couple of times, and you know he made Ole Miss nationally relevant. And by the way, then he went to Liberty. He took a quarterback that people didn't think could play at Auburn, and he helped turn him into an NFL quarterback. And they won a lot of games. You know, Malik Willis. And here he is. I mean, I don't think the difference between him and Lane Kiffin coaching wise is, you know, if you ask me who's the better coach, I'm not sure who I would say. They're both really good play callers. Freeze still does it, although he said he might not do that anymore. I think they're different in how they operate. Lane, quite honestly, is very adept at using social media, and it's almost Freeze's downfall.
Well, that was one of the weird parts of his press conference is somebody asked him, I guess there was a report that part of his
Pat Forty had reported, our friend Pat Forty at Sports Illustrated, I guess, had reported. And the only reason why I know it was Forty is because I saw Brandon Marcello, is another national writer we know, who had, you know, referenced Pat's report, because I was like, maybe I've seen this a few other places, because I definitely had heard it on the day before this happened, about that part of him getting the job would be him relinquishing his social media accounts, which, you know, at the nature of that, it's like, wait, you can't even operate your Twitter account, but you can run a football program in the
SEC. That's exactly right. If that is true and he denies it, I would question why Auburn is hiring a football coach who they don't trust with his own Twitter account. So I just looked at the official tweet that welcome home, Coach Hugh Freeze. Why is that home? Why is Auburn home? Welcome home. I thought he's a Mississippi.
Back to the SEC.
Okay, maybe that's it. The first wave of responses: damn you for this, boo. There's still time to turn back if he hasn't signed.
Are these Auburn fans you're talking about?
You can't tell for sure, but disgraceful. I've never been more ashamed of my alma mater. Yeah, I mean, it could be fans from other schools, but yeah, I'm surprised it's not more. But hey, look, it's Auburn. Have they ever hired a coach that everybody was enamored with? Probably not.
No, probably not. I mean, if it has, it's got to go a long ways back.
I think from a football standpoint, just that the thing I really focus on is, he was such a thorn in Nick Saban's side when he was coaching against him, you know, beat him 2 years in a row. And I think the third year it was, you know, a wild shootout that Alabama won. That's why he hired Lane Kiffin as his OC, which, remember, at the time seemed, you know, people couldn't believe Nick Saban was doing that. He's like, I've seen what this team is doing with RPO, with what Hugh Freeze's offense is doing with RPOs, screen game. You need to figure out something like this for us.
So much so that he hired Dan Werner, who was Freeze's offensive coordinator, as an analyst. And Dan Werner came in there and worked 3 days a week and then watched games back in Oxford with his family. Like, it was he was that enamored with what they did, to the point where when Dan Werner interviewed, you know, Saban's pumping him for information, at one point he goes, wait, that's all really you guys do? And he goes, yeah, this is it. And it was just like, it was way more simple, I think, in terms of like premise, than probably what Saban thought.
So I can't imagine he's thrilled that guy is now coaching at his arch rival. So if I'm an Auburn fan, I would be focused on that. Back to the podcast in a second, but Bruce, even this late into the spring, you know, we're still seeing college football programs hiring staff members, support staff members, analysts, GAs, whatnot. Hope they've been using LinkedIn Jobs, because if you're hiring for your small business, You want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to post your job for free at linkedin.com/audible. That's linkedin.com/audible to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Should we get to the mailbag?
All right. As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. The first question is from Brian Black in Atlanta. Are Georgia and Michigan exploiting inefficiencies in modern college football? Both teams have very similar offensive styles, big offensive lines, physical downhill rushing attacks, multiple tight ends, and solid quarterback play. Today's college football defenses are built to defend spread offenses and thus often lack the defensive personnel to handle more traditional offenses. Do you think the success of Georgia and Michigan will lead to more schools moving away from the spread offense? That is a good question from
That is a really good question. Just the first thing that stands out to me, you know, it's true. Those teams both do a great job of utilizing their tight ends. I feel like Georgia has two tight ends on the field. I mean, we could look up the exact snap count, but a lot. And it makes you remember that, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, maybe a little longer, the prevailing notion was that the tight end was going to be extinct soon because spread offenses were 4 or 5 wide. They're not the only ones. Obviously Notre Dame does it with Michael Mayer and others, but you know, the emphasis they put on it is unique. I think what those two programs are doing a really good job of, though, like they're not running. I mean, Josh Gattis himself came with all the RPOs and all that. And so they're not running like a 1970s style, run it down your throat pro style offense. They're blending both. That's probably going to be the future, right? Like we went all the way in one direction. I don't think we're going to go all the way back in the other direction, but you're going to see more blending of those two styles. It requires, it helps if you're Georgia and you can recruit whoever you want, because there's just not a lot of guys that fit that prototype. But he's right. Like defenses have been spending years, defensive coordinators have been spending years rethinking their approach, rethinking which kind of athletes they want in an effort to defend spread teams.
I'm going to read this. So for our story last week, where I talked to a bunch of coaches who played Michigan and or Ohio State, this is from a veteran offensive line coach who played one of those teams. Everybody in college football is built to defend the spread and the zone read now. Michigan is going to mash you in the face and still do that stuff with the quarterback run. What they do is really unique now. Everybody wants to say we're tough and we have a nasty O-line, but then you watch what they do and you see them running a bunch of RPOs. But these guys at Michigan have that mentality where they're running real run plays that they call, and they know they're going to grind you for 5 or 6 yards. That's what I respect about those guys. They've cultivated that and their kids have bought in. They're going to get into 22 personnel and do inside run drill with 12 plays of the power and inside zone. It's all about how they rip it and how they work it. You create a mental toughness to get through those things. I love watching them play. One of the big things is alignment. The wide receivers are on board. They block their butts off. 15 or 20 years ago, everybody was doing what Michigan is doing now. They've brought it back full circle. It's so refreshing to me as an old O-line guy, end quote.
There you go. So, yeah. I mean, his question is basically, do you see more teams abandoning the spread and doing that?
I do. I don't know if it's going to be a massive influx, but I do think you will. I know you will see more teams try to do that because I think they see how the parts come together and how they work.
That's the beauty of college football. These things are constantly moving in different cycles.
Next question is from Andrew. Hey guys, so Matt Rule's contract is for 8 years. Has Nebraska learned nothing from the long-term contracts given to the likes of Jimbo Fisher and Mel Tucker? I understand the money from the new TV contract is huge, but given that program has so many question marks and plays in a conference that it cannot compete in, why not go for a coach on the rise, a Kalen DeBoer, Lance Leipold type, who would have come much cheaper? And if it doesn't work, you're not committed to it for so long.
So the key question there, maybe you know the answer, Bruce. Is it 9 years guaranteed?
Eight.
8 years, yes. That's right. It's fully guaranteed.
So the deal with him is going to be, I don't know if it's fully guaranteed. I think it is, but I don't know that for sure. The thing with him is, I don't think Matt Rhule was coming if it was for a six-year deal. So my understanding is the first time they came to him, didn't sound like he was wanted the job. They circled back with him. It was longer-term deal. And I think that kind of security of what it would took made it work. So look, you and I both talked about this the other day. You said it was a higher. I thought it was a plus higher for Nebraska. I don't think they're getting him for that. And the question is, Kalen DeBoer is a really good coach. I don't know if that, you know, I know they were sniffing around and then Washington jumped on him. You know, if you asked me, let's say Lance Leipold versus Matt Rhule, as good as you and I both think, and I don't want to speak for you, but like, I think Lance Leipold's done a terrific job. I think Matt Rhule is a bigger get for them, you know? And so I think sometimes you got to swing for the fences. They have the money. They were going to do it. Now the Jimbo Fisher thing and the Mel Tucker, I guess this is that kind of money though. You know, it's similar where you can't.
Yeah. So out. I found the details. It is 90% guaranteed. That is, yeah. I believe Brian Kelly at LSU got that same thing. And here's what's interesting. It's $74 million, an average of $9.25 million per season, but it's very low in the beginning and very, very high in the end. So,
well, because the Panthers part of this, right?
Yeah, so $5.5 million this coming year.
And then but it gets to like 12.5.
It gets up to 12.5 by the end. My point is, because of that, that 90% guarantee is even more is worse than it would normally be, because so much of the money is due at the end. So yeah, they've basically committed to him for 8 years. And I just think that I forget if I said this on a radio interview or our podcast or somebody else's podcast, this is all monopoly money. Now it's all just a show of commitment. Like whether it's 74 million or 90 million or whatever, it's just, we want to show everybody, we want to flex and show that we can spend this kind of money. And this is how committed we are to restoring Nebraska to championship material. So, you know, your worst case scenario is you end up in a Jimbo Fisher type situation, right? Where we just can't move on from this guy. But, you know, this is the same school that just like wasted $7.5 million that they could have, you know, saved in 3 weeks. They just have more money than they know what to do with. And that's going to be, and this is before the next Big Ten football TV deal kicks in, and they're going to have even more money.
Good point. You want to ask me the next question of Craig in Detroit?
Craig in Detroit. Oh, I like this one. Hey, guys. Now that Jimbo has fixed the Aggies' offensive problems by firing Daryl Dickey, sarcasm, who do you think he calls? I think he needs to go a bit more Texas air raid friendly. Here are my three calls. Jake Spavital, now the former Texas State head coach, Garrett Riley, gained momentum from the TCU bump, and Zach Kittley, the Texas Tech OC.
All good choices. I don't know. Now, two of those guys have jobs. One of them is looking again. The tricky thing here is, and I've heard a little of this, where, you know, our guys, is Jimbo a guy you definitely want to work for in this capacity? And that'll be interesting to see. Yeah, they have a ton of money, but you got to be really careful on, you go there and if it doesn't go well, you know, you're digging out of a hole, you know, it can be pretty miserable pretty fast. It is interesting because the name I had thought of, there's two guys I thought of, and they're both actually head coaches and they're really good offensive coaches. I don't know if either would do it. One of them, now it's got complicated. The first guy I'll say is Sean Lewis, who is the head coach at Kent State, really good offensive coach. You know, I don't know if, like, you know, he did a really good job. He got them to a bowl game, to win a bowl game, but that's a tough job in there. And he's not winning, you know, like they're struggling. right? And so can he win enough to get a head coaching job out of there? I don't know. It's not looking so great. So I'd heard some rumblings that maybe some head coaches were going to talk to him about, would you want to come and be my offensive coordinator? You know, so that was one name. The other one was at an FCS school, and that's G.J. Kinney. The only thing is G.J. Kinney right now, from my understanding, is like the favorite to get the Tulsa head coaching job at his alma mater. So, but he's tearing it up at Incarnate Word in San Antonio. And I could see them being attracted to him as a possible play caller. But, you know, this would be an interesting hire because you're going to go in there. If you do take the job, I don't think you'll get to bring your O-line coach because Steve Adazio is there, you know, and maybe they'll turn over other guys on the staff. But I think it's just, you do inherit, I think, potentially very good receivers because, you know, between Moose Muhammad and Stewart, you got, you know, really good young receivers. And everything I've heard about Wegman, the freshman quarterback, has been really positive, not just about his arm, but also about like his makeup and everything. So there's, you know, you can hit it. It's just, I think guys are going to want to go in going, all right, do I really feel comfortable working for Jimbo in this capacity?
I don't see Jimbo pivoting all the way from, you know, whatever you want to call his pro style offense to air raid. Like that's pretty radical. I see it. He's going to have to kind of do what Jim Harbaugh did when he decided to modernize his offense. And he brought in Josh Gattis and it was an adjustment. Like that first year they were, what was the game? Was an Army game where they just couldn't stop fumbling. Yeah. I mean, it was hard to watch. But it eventually took hold and it was a good way to kind of blend those two styles. And so I would think he's going to be looking to do something like that. I don't have a name for you. I will say that when I saw this, I'm like, you know what? You remember the year that Graham Harrell was like every school in America wanted him to be their offensive coordinator. That's Garrett Riley this year, isn't it?
If you're Garrett Riley, you like Sonny is a really good guy to work for from everything I've heard. And if you're Garrett Riley, you're at a good school where you can, you know, you're built to win now and keep winning. Your next stop, I don't think should be like to be somebody else's offensive coordinator. It should be keep developing and then get ready for to run your own program, especially if you have a head coach who gives you a lot of freedom and also is an offensive minded guy who can help you. I think he's in a really good situation. Kittley is at his alma mater where his dad's kind of a legend, you know, in the athletic department. I don't think, you know, again, he's like you said, I'm not sure that Jimbo's going to want to buy into all the stuff Zach Kittley's doing. Right.
I don't think so. It's just too, you have to do something. Like where these coaches get into trouble is like they hand over the reins to somebody like this. But they're so uncomfortable with it that the first time the team struggles, give me back the playbook. We're going to do it my way now.
Yeah. I mean, that's a bad place to be in, especially if you're coming from good situations. Look, I'm pretty sure Jake Spavital is going to have some opportunities at some places. I think he will be choosy on, you know, where it is, but you know, look, it would be enticing to go work with Wegman and those receivers, assuming, you know, none of those guys transfer out.
Adam Tarrow, big fan of the podcast and hopeful future sports journalist. Run while you can, Adam. I'm just kidding. He's wondering why Oregon State head coach Jonathan Smith hasn't been discussed more for head coaching positions in this cycle. The team has finished with a better record every year than the previous one, except for 2020. And he just finished the regular season with a rivalry win over top 10 rival Oregon. They will likely finish in the top 20. So I was curious what can be said about his candidacy for other positions.
He is a really good coach who is very down to earth. He's a Southern California guy. Like if Chip Kelly left UCLA, I would think Jonathan Smith would be a guy they should, you know, it's home for him. He grew up really close to there. He's obviously done very, very well at his alma mater. You know, the Pac-12 is interesting in this regard where it's either like, you know, Oregon State, you look at now it's his alma mater, but like some of these jobs, like Cal has a lot of issues, right? It's you know, internally, you know, alignment, all that stuff. Stanford has challenges. Then you start to get at some of these other places like CU. You don't think it's a better job. Arizona State is kind of reeling. You know, Washington definitely is. Oregon definitely is. But I don't know if you're Oregon, or you would you be hiring the guy from Corvallis who you know, was your arch rival? You know, I mean, it doesn't mean he's only a West Coast guy, but he is a West Coast guy through and through. I'll say this, like, you know, just from getting to know him, like, he's the guy who's watching Dodger games like before he goes to sleep at night. You know, like, he's, I don't know. I think he's a really good coach. I think he would, I don't see him like as an SEC guy. I think he will not just take a big job to take a big job, right? I think it would have to be a really good fit in a place he wants to be, you know?
I would imagine, because he is a great coach. In fact, when it came down to, when we were doing our picks last week, which, by the way, I crushed it last week in the picks, finally. I picked Oregon State because I just thought to myself, I just trust Jonathan Smith more than I do Dan Lanning at this point. So, but I think two problems. One, they play all their games at 10:30 at night. So I don't think any, you know, ADs east of the Rockies ever see his teams play. And I'm sure that there's some people who just assume, well, he's never going to leave his alma mater, right? So yeah, the UCLA one, that's intriguing. There's a Pac-12 school in my backyard that needs a football coach right now. I don't know if, you know, you leave Oregon State for Stanford necessarily. But no, I kind of expect him to be there a while.
I do too. I'd be happy if I was a Beaver fan. He's one of our own. He's done really well. I think he's just a really good football coach. I don't know how much I don't know what the ceiling is for Oregon State football. You know, it feels like it's certainly not what the Ducks are. You know, Mike Riley had that year where they won the Fiesta. Actually, it was Dennis Erickson who won the Fiesta Bowl.
Yeah, Dennis Erickson. I mean, this was pretty when I just kind of first started out, and I don't think I appreciated how unusual and rare that was, that Oregon State finished like number two or three in the country that year and clobbered Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl with Chad Johnson and
TJ Houshmandzadeh.
TJ Houshmandzadeh. Yeah. And Jonathan Smith. That was a great team. Ken Simonton was the running back.
Yeah,
Ken but you know, my
Steven Jackson blur together. I forgot about Ken Simonton being before Steven, you know, Steven Jackson was a little later.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike Riley had some great players come through there. They screwed things up for USC a couple times. So, you know, and the ceiling is not Oregon, you're right, but it's pretty high. You're the LA guy, so I'm gonna ask you this question from Ryan in Redondo Beach, not far from you. I moved to Los Angeles last year, and I went to the UCLA-USC game last week as an interested third party, hoping to check off my pilgrimage and catch a great rivalry game. The game itself sure delivered, but afterwards I was surprised that neither of you had mentioned UCLA in last week's mailbag on which Power 5 teams need a new stadium. The Rose Bowl, while iconic for its namesake bowl game, leaves much to be desired for the regular season experience. As you guys mentioned, it was the highest-ranked matchup for the two in over a decade, and they still couldn't claim a sellout without tarping over most of the end zone seats. With UCLA's upcoming move to the Big Ten set to refill their athletic department funds, do you ever see them building a smaller stadium on or close to campus that can reliably motivate fans to support the mat? Would they better be served playing at SoFi? I'm going to say no to that last part, but what about the campus on close part? Close to campus part?
It's hard for them. I don't know if they have space for any of that. You know, like, 1 year, and I don't remember what the reason was, they played at, and I don't know if Ryan lived here at this point, but they played, no, he didn't, because I see he moved here last year, but they played in Carson, and it used to be called the StubHub Center. Now it's like Dignity Health, and it's where the LA Galaxy play, and it's a great little venue, and it's fun to see a soccer game, but it's not a huge stadium. And look, the Chargers played there for a minute too. It's not close to where they are, but it's kind of an intimate setting. And I think that would be ideal. Like, TCU has not a very big stadium. It's a nice stadium, but it's, you know, maybe it's 45,000 now. You look at some of these schools, Miami, that's what they should be doing, I think. And it's just like, but like Miami, you know, real estate is insanely hard to come by in Southern California. And
but
so
John Ruiz is swearing that he's going to build a stadium for the Miami Hurricanes on
you hate John Ruiz,
on a park in no, I don't hate him, but he makes a lot of grandiose claims and promises on Twitter, and apparently he's claiming he's going to build a college football stadium. I think he might. One, the only thing I would say, yeah, like they've had some serious attendance problems there. Not selling out the Rose Bowl for the UCLA USC game. I mean, the Rose Bowl is 95,000 seats. That might seem like an easy thing to do in the SEC, but that's a tall ask. You know, I think USC the other night for Notre Dame, they sold out, and a sellout for them is like 73,000, something like that. That's a big number for a college football game in LA.
But that's also what, like, USC UCLA, they said they had this sellout at 71,000 or 72,000. He was mentioned in the tarps that took it down to 72,000, I guess.
Yeah, look, that's not – you're never going to fill the entire Rose Bowl like they do for the bowl game itself for a UCLA home game. But it's not anywhere near UCLA. It's not a modern stadium by any means. So I get what he's saying. But yeah, where would you, let's say you decide to build a 50,000 seat stadium, 40,000, I don't know, you know, a mid-sized stadium. I can't imagine there's the land to do that anywhere near Westwood.
No, I don't think there, I mean, what do I know? But I don't think there, that's not an easy thing because it's just so expensive for the land there and everything is kind of jammed together.
In the course of reporting that Stanford story, I found out this obscure thing, which is that, and I don't know if this is unique to Stanford or if other colleges have to do this, but they have an agreement with their county. Even though it's their land, they own the land on the campus, they still are limited in how much they can develop it. So like basically there's like it's like your electricity meter. Like you get a certain number of square feet and you can't go past that. So if UCLA wanted to build a stadium on their campus, I bet you they have to go through an insane amount of bureaucracy. Okay. Just one more. Okay?
This one question from Daniel.
Michael Penix.
Yeah, in Fairfax, Virginia. Guys, I love the pod. Be the show that actually sheds light on this. Caleb Williams, 3,712 yards, 34 TDs and 3 INTs, plus 351 rushing yards and 10 touchdowns. Michael Penix Jr., 4,354 yards. That's over 600 yards more. 29 touchdowns. That's 5 touchdown passes less. 7 interceptions. That's 4 more. And probably about a little less than 300 yards rushing and 6 TDs less. So he doesn't quite have the rushing numbers, but his passing numbers match up reasonably well to Caleb's. He's also not on a bad team, by the way, and I'll continue what Daniel says. I'm not saying Penix should win, but how is he not in the conversation? Washington was 4-8 last year, and I promise they wouldn't have been anywhere close to 10-2 without Penix this year. He should be in New York, and no one even mentions him. Look at the numbers compared to anyone.
He's right. I mean, it's a really weird thing. He's never, just all season long, he's never really gained traction, and you can't say he's not a well-known name. He definitely is. I think the problem was they had two really bad losses in the middle of the season, and he performed poorly in both of them. The UCLA loss, I think that was on a Friday night, and Arizona State, which Boo Corrigan has not forgiven them for. So I think he just kind of like nobody was thinking of him as a Heisman candidate after that. Now he's made a heck of a final push, starting with the Oregon game. But as I've said many times, I just think with all the emphasis, like we've started every podcast, right, for the last 4 weeks talking about these playoff rankings, the entire focus of the sport is on the playoff. It's very hard to win the Heisman not being on a playoff contending team. And they just haven't been in that mix. They may well go to the Rose Bowl. But you know, it seems to me the Heisman is always going to go to somebody on one of those four teams. And Caleb Williams is in position to do that. The one I'm more puzzled by is Max Duggan. Why does nobody... They named the finalists for a lot of the, you know, the awards they give out on that ESPN show.
He's a Big O'Brien finalist.
Yes, but what about the Maxwell Award for most outstanding player in the country? CJ Stroud's one of the three, and Duggan is not.
So let me ask you this. I feel like we're cheating when I say this, but you're not supposed to reveal your ballot, but neither one of us has voted yet. If I said to you, rank the top five candidates right now, who would yours be?
Well, I know who my top three are because of who I submitted to our Heisman straw poll this week. And that was Caleb Williams, Max Duggan, and I went Bryce Young number three. I still think Bryce Young is one of the most outstanding players in college football. I would then put Penix four. I'd have to think about five for seconds. Go ahead.
Caleb was my clear one. I am still riding Hendon Hooker in this thing. I know he's injured, but just what I think he's meant to the program. My number three this week is Deuce Vaughn. It was almost like a appreciation.
He's great. He's great. He's another guy nobody ever talks about. He's great.
I would have Duggan four, and I would have Penix five.
What do you do with Blake Corum? He's had a phenomenal season, but he unfortunately couldn't really play in the biggest game of the season.
Yeah, I mean he played probably like 10 snaps, I'm guessing. You know, he's very deserving to get there. I think, you know, his numbers are not, they're really good. They're not great numbers relative to, you know, if you're going to win the Heisman. I mean, the problem he has is you got Chase Brown, who's in the same competition, who is rushing for more yards, and Mo Ibrahim, who missed a game and has even bigger numbers. You know, it's just like the Big Ten. I think there's somebody else I'm forgetting too in the Big Ten who's put up pretty good rushing numbers. Oh, it's
Muhammad Ibrahim.
No, I just said him. The other one I was forgetting is Braylon Allen's like over 1,100 yards too. But okay. It's like you see a bunch of guys in there. So it's Chase Brown over 1,600 yards, Ibrahim almost 1,600, and then you go down to Corum 1,463. I mean, it's just those are really good numbers. But I don't, you know, I think it's hard to. I don't know. It's hard to do. I think it's hard for a running back right now to win unless you just have absolutely insane numbers or you're on the national title team.
I think you have to do more than be a running back at this point. You have to be Christian McCaffrey. And those don't come around very often.
And he didn't win it.
And even he didn't win it. I'm going to rearrange mine a little bit after hearing you and after thinking about it a little bit more. I would move Hendon Hooker. I'm with you. You know, appreciation award. Up to three, and then I would push Bryce Young to four and have Michael Penix five.
No, I think that's all reasonable. So, Daniel, we appreciate the question. It's a good talking point. You know, he's definitely got some wow skills in his arm, no doubt. I mean, you see some of the throws he's made this year have been just fantastic. So
one thing I will just add is that I don't, those Heisman, I mean, no offense, Matt Fortuna, I don't put a whole lot of thought into the weekly Heisman straw poll before I send that email. But before I cast the real ballot on Monday, I mean, I sit down and go through all of the possible candidates and which games they did well in, which games they didn't, and so on and so forth. So I do take that thing pretty seriously. And then I can't tell you who is in it. So unfortunately, we'd have to wait until after the ceremony. And at that point, I don't know how much people care. I think people just like, okay, that's who won. Great.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's just how it is now. But moving along, so we got championship games this week to watch. We haven't really talked
about it. I think we're both going to the same championship game.
Are you going to Vegas? For
different reasons. Yes, I'm going to Vegas to cover the game, and you are going to Vegas to just watch the game for fun.
Yeah. Go to play, to the casino.
I think that USC, I don't really understand why people think Utah is a great team this year. Now that I said that, they'll upset USC, but I'm kind of expecting USC to roll. What about you?
I am expecting them to roll as well.
You just think they've caught fire at the right time.
Yeah, I think this is a chance to avenge that defeat. I thought, it was a great game, and it was a great, really, really tremendous game. Like when you're the other quarterback and you can, I don't know if he upstaged Caleb, but he kind of did. I feel like USC's defense is starting to play a little better. It's not just getting turnovers. Like they actually have done some decent things in addition to that. So I don't know. I mean, I think USC is going to flex its muscle and light up Utah this time around.
We shall see. We will reconvene on Sunday after the playoff field and is set. So, as always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we will see you next time.